Joining us on the phone from London, Ontario, nutritional consultant Pam Colleen. How are you?
I'm happy. I love that song.
Excellent. Isn't that a great song? Oh, it's so infectious, and it just gets you immediately when I hear it, I get in a good mood.
Yes, and I'm glad Greg mentioned butter, because butter makes you very happy.
Hey, we did not prepare for this, although you prepare much more than I. I have minimal input into the preparation of what you're going to say, but what is this? My afternoon colleague, Larry Fedoric, blogged about it. Oil pulling.
Oh, yeah. I have some clients who try that. I believe it's an old Ayurvedic type of detoxification method where people use things like sesame oil and they leave it in their mouths in order to pull the toxins out through.
Well, he's using coconut, which is coconut oil, which everyone is like, oh, coconut oil is the, you know, it's much better for you. I mean, it used to be, oh my God, coconut oil, you know how much, what is it, monounsaturated fat? And everyone's like, yeah, that's the point. That's why it's good for you now. So what is it supposed to do?
It's supposed to pull out the toxins through the gums and such, right? So it's just a method of detoxification. And some people sit on the fence and say they don't notice a difference. Other people tell me that they notice improvements in terms of their gum health, for example, in doing so. But to me, I just think that there's so much more to detoxification than doing oil pulling. It's more of a superficial type of detoxification. If people want to try it, it's certainly not going to hurt anybody.
Okay. All right. So something to try. Maybe people. There's some people. And one of the things, whiter teeth. You're like, really? Yeah. All right. Who knows? I just thought, you know, if anyone would have an opinion on it, you would do it. Here's someone. I've been oil pulling for 4 weeks. Okay. Well, what are the results? Tell me what the results are if you've been oil pulling for 4 weeks. But we move on. To preview this little segment, like I said, we're going to talk to Pam Colleen about birth and death. You know, we're going to talk about you coming into the world and leaving this world. And the thing I wanted to talk to you first about birth, I could not believe this to be true. You completely caught me off guard on this story. Mm-hmm. That one of the recommendations, and from Health Canada, not from somebody, you know, it's like, Health Canada, which you and a number of people have taken issue with before on a number of recommendations, Canada Food Guide being chief among them, but Health Canada has recommended for a baby's first food, when a baby is ready to go from ideally breast milk, and then for some women, it's, you know, we'll talk formula. I don't want to talk about that, though. The ideal first food is not what many people think it should be.
That's right. Health Canada has come up with some new recommendations, and it's unfortunate that they had the recommendations they had in place for so many years, and that was to start children off with cereal. And now they're essentially eating crow, and they're saying, no, we were wrong. We should have been recommending meat and eggs beyond the breastfeeding phase. Now they're acknowledging the fact that, you know, that these rice cereals or other cereals are actually hard on the child's digestive tract, and they're not natural to introduce as a first food. So I think Health Canada should be acknowledged for making this very daring new recommendation, admitting that they've been wrong. And parents, of course, can celebrate, because it's actually going to help your child so much more if you start them off on things like meat and eggs versus these rice cereals, for example.
And so it goes against conventional wisdom. When you think of, what are you feeding your baby? Pablum. You're feeding them rice, you know, like this rice mush. We're feeding them chopped up vegetables. But it's like, when you look at what the science says, it's like, you know what? It may look like mush, but it is hard in the digestive tract. They don't have what it takes to digest it yet.
No, they don't have the correct enzymes in place to break down these starchy foods like rice or wheat or whatever. They just don't have the enzymes in place to break those foods down. And so it's not a natural process. It was always illogical to recommend that because, you know, we're just not designed from birth to break these foods down. And unfortunately, you're starting off with a high carbohydrate diet like that. I mean, that's basically a lot of sugar coming into the system. And unfortunately, that will set children up for sugar addiction, obesity, diabetes, et cetera, down the road. So it's not wise to start children off on all of that sugar.
It's interesting because they also, though, try to couch it. First, complementary foods should be iron-rich, they say. They recommend meat. Meat alternatives. I don't know what that is.
Well, and they're making a mistake there.
And iron fortified cereal. And again, they go back and it's like, well, as long as it's iron fortified, you're okay with cereal. It's like,
yeah, you know, they're still contradicting themselves on some points. But I, you know, I think if people are at least well versed on the ancestral diet, they'll be able to see through some of their misinformation still. The bottom line is that they should be acknowledged for at least turning the corner and saying, oh, you know, meat and eggs are you know, never joined the dark side, and they're very good for children. When they mention things like meat alternatives, unfortunately, they're referring to things like soy, and that's just them trying to appease the soy industry. That's, they should know better than to recommend soy. Soy in a child's diet is devastating simply because, again, this is something that is going to challenge their digestive system. So it's really contradictory that the Health Canada would include things like soy in the recommendations. Soy would be also hard on the digestive tract of a child. And also with all of that estrogen coming into the body, it's really going to mess with their developing hormonal system. So it's going to cause a lot of problems to put children on things like soy foods or soy milk, anything along that line.
Infants, according to Health Canada, infants should be offered iron-containing foods two or more times each day. They should be served meat, fish, poultry, or meat alternatives daily. The amount of food offered should be guided by the infant's hunger and satiety cues. Breastfeeding continues to provide the main source of nutrition as other foods are introduced. Now, Greg just whispered into my ear, how does the baby cut the meat? I mean, meat can be, and it's like, well, I guess you cut it. But do we even go? There was an actress, and I can't remember her name, who pre-masticated some of her infant's food. And people are like, that's crazy. But in terms of meat, I'm like, well, yeah, it's not pablum. It's not mush. A baby doesn't have teeth. So,
yeah, but
so
a lot of animals in nature would do that, you know. So it's, I don't think that that's too shocking. But a lot of mothers, what they actually do is puree the meat.
Okay, there. Yeah, so we have to soften it somehow. Or as one, Alicia Silverstone was the actress. So she would pre-chew her infant's food and then give them the food, almost like a bird feeding a baby, mm-hmm. you know. And so it's like, all right, that's kind of, it seems a little weird for some of us. But the meat part is the key. The meat, the poultry, the fish. Those are the recommendations by Health Canada, which I think goes against a lot of people's commonly accepted wisdom.
That's right. And I think a lot of parents are out there, unfortunately, probably a little upset by this information because they would have started their children off on grains. And now, in hindsight, of course, we can't reverse the situation, but it goes against all of nature to have done that. But fortunately, you know, going back to our ancestral foods, going back to eating things like meat and eggs and butter and so on, going back to these foods certainly can undo a lot of the damage that's been done. But it just takes a lot of focus, a lot of determination, because unfortunately, once people have been raised on a high carbohydrate diet, they're so addicted to the carbohydrate diet, it can be a little challenging getting them to revert back to eating the ancestral foods.
And the science says most healthy term infants are born with sufficient stores of iron until they are 6 months old, after which iron stores are depleted and breast milk alone can no longer meet all of the infant's nutrient requirements. It's essential to growth, cognitive, neurological, motor, and behavioral development. So this is why iron, after especially 6 months, when you're introducing supplementary food to your child, meat is the recommended choice. Wow.
Let's not forget that the mother needs to be eating these foods as well.
That's right.
So that she builds up her iron stores. But not just iron, B12, zinc, all sorts of very important nutrients that are going to come from eating the animal foods. She will confer that benefit to the child before birth, during birth, and after birth. Right? So it's important for the mother's health as well.
Quick break in the program. All right, from birth to death, how to starve it off. Well, don't starve. How to stave it off. Maybe put a few pounds on. Yeah, we'll talk about that next with Pam Colleen here on 610 CKTV. 21 minutes after 11 o'clock, Pam Colleen, nutritional consultant, joining us from London, Ontario. And oftentimes we've been told you have to lose weight. I mean, I talked about John Panette, who's a comedian who died. And I said, look at the list of overweight comedians who have died early. Look at people who are overweight. Oh, my God, it's a health risk. It's a health risk. It's a health risk. However, according to new research in the Journal of American Medical Association, overweight may lead to what? A longer life. Pam Colleen, although overweight, we shouldn't say, is the same as morbidly obese, but it's right. better to be a little overweight than a little underweight. Why is that?
This is what the new research is saying, essentially, that our eye has been off the target, that, you know, we associate with obesity and overweight with an increased risk of disease, early death, et cetera, et cetera. But what this new research is basically suggesting is that it's actually even riskier to be underweight. And the researchers are cautioning people to say, stop striving to be really skinny. And their baseline, and I still can't wrap my brain around the BMI measurement.
Well, yeah.
The BMI measurement is mathematical, and people can do the mathematics about a BMI easily online. But the BMI measurement is 18.5. So if you're under an 18.5 BMI, then they're saying you're basically at a greater risk of all sorts of health problems versus somebody who is obese. And they're not saying that there's no risk to being obese. They're definitely seeing that. But it's even, obviously, it's just riskier if you're skinny. And so they've seen this obsession, Tom. These researchers have seen this obsession with people striving to be skinny. And they're just saying, stop. Stop doing that. It's not a healthy goal to have.
Well, obese, they're like overweight but not obese. So according to their BMI, you are underweight if your BMI, and again, there's problems with BMI. Again, imperfect, but a better tool than just the eyeball. 18.5. Normal between 18 and 5 and 25. Overweight between 25 and 30, obese is a BMI over 30, okay? So they said people who are overweight, so not normal, overweight, but not obese, were 6% less likely to die during the average study period than even normal weight people. But even people we consider of a normal weight, quote unquote normal, is like, yeah, they actually, and one of the reasons may be all the energy it takes when you come down with a disease or a condition, how hard the body has to fight to, you know, stave it off, all the energy it takes. When you're overweight, you got a little extra. You got a little battery pack, if you will.
Exactly. So we're actually drawing from a couple of different researchers here. There's growing and growing interest in saying, what is an ideal weight? And one of the messages we've been learning through all of this research is that we can't pay attention to these ideal body weight charts, that they are extremely misleading and in many cases making many of us much sicker. So ignore those body weight charts that you might be reading online, because they're just arbitrary numbers. So they're not based on science whatsoever. So it's about trying to reach maybe some kind of moderate weight, where you mentioned there, Tom, between, say, 25 and 30 on the BMI scale. And that might mean, you know, if you compare that weight that you discover there at a healthy weight, if you feel good and so on, that may be indeed 20 pounds more than what some of these charts are indicating. So just stay between in a moderate weight zone and ignore the goal of being skinny or thin, because that's not proving to be healthy.
And they also found that post-surgery, that people who are slightly overweight survive better. For instance, on heart surgery, people who are slightly overweight survive a little better than people who are not. And I'm like, really? I'm like, yep. And it's so surprising in terms of, you know, no one is saying, well, the ideal body, I think, though, our perception is changing a bit. No longer. I mean, there was a story in the papers today where Yale University told a woman who is naturally thin, but they're like, you have to put on weight. She was 92 pounds. She's 5'2", 92 pounds. All right. So, you know, maybe she could use a couple extra pounds. But we're now not thinking that's the ideal body type. We're now worried about her. It's like, you're too thin. You need to eat a sandwich or three.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, this goes back in terms of our perceptions of beauty over the centuries. Okay, so in history, and if you've ever been into a museum, Tom, where you see a lot of these great, you know, artists and the portraits of women over the centuries, she always had some curves, right?
Yeah, Rubenesque, as we described it.
Beautiful. That was considered attractive, is for a woman to have curves, right? But then what happened was we had the invention of the girdle, And then we had, in the 1920s, you had the flapper dancers that were super skinny, right? And you had the Great Depression, so people were starving and were very skinny. But unfortunately, that was almost normalized from the Great Depression on. And then you had some actresses that stepped forward and some supermodels that stepped forward, like Twiggy, for example. And all of this normalization of being skinny suddenly became synonymous with beautiful. But it's really synthetically drawn from history. It's not normal and it's not natural. And unfortunately, it keeps getting reinforced through the media, through the modeling industry or what have you, through actors and actresses. And then that's what we have to get away from, because that is actually very new to humans. And if our ancestors saw what we perceive to be beautiful today, they'd be rolling over in their graves.
Let me ask you this before I let you go. My Greg was talking in my ear in his annoying sort of way. And he said, it's not that easy, you know. Greg is, by all accounts, healthy, good-looking guy, skinny as a rail. I mean, when he turns sideways, he disappears. His shadow.
I believe I'm underweight.
I think most people would agree Greg is underweight. What do you recommend? How does a guy like that? I mean, he's in his 30s, so it's not like, oh, you'll grow into your body or whatever. I certainly grew into mine. I graduated high school at 155 pounds at the same height, 6'2". I am certainly heavier than that now. How does someone gain weight, though?
This is a tricky one, because when somebody eats and eats and eats and they can't gain weight, it's actually a sign of something called fast oxidation. And I can tell you, Tom, you've just opened up a can of worms. To get out of a state of fast oxidation is not easy to do. It's not healthy to be in fast oxidation. But it's something that I work with every day. I have a lot of clients who are in fast oxidation, and I have to help them get out of fast oxidation so that they can gain weight.
Do you prescribe more beer and wings, or what do you do? Or no, but I guess...
That doesn't work.
That doesn't work, yeah, so we'd have to go to the opposite. We'd have to go, you know what, Greg, you're going to have to go on a Pablum diet. What about the sumo? The sumo guys eat one meal a day. That's it. Maybe that's what we should
All
do.
All
porridge, something like that. Pam, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Take care.
Take care, bye.
All right. Anyone else have problem gaining weight?
I graduated high school at 135 pounds.
What do you weigh now?
Probably 125.
Really? I graduated high school at 155 pounds. I now weigh 215 pounds. And I'm not obese.
No, you're fit.
I don't think I'm overweight, and I could lose a little.
You're like an NHL goalie. 6'2", 215. Perfect.
I'm 6'3". All right. 6'2", really.
All right. Sorry.
I got a little extra height, yeah. All right. I'll give you some of the extra pounds I don't want.
Right.
It was only that easy.
The famous line. I'll give you some.
News is next.